Welcome to the Talk About Teddy podcast. We want to thank each and every one of our listeners for your support and interest. We apologize for the delay in releasing a new episode. We've experienced some technical difficulties, and we appreciate your patience and understanding. But don't worry, a new episode is on the way.
So do you have questions you'd like us to answer, either about ourselves or Theodore Roosevelt? Now's your chance. Send your questions to talkaboutteddypodcast@gmail.com. We'll answer your questions in either one episode or at the beginning of future podcast episodes, and we look forward to your questions.
Also, we have been downloaded on 6 continents. Bully!
Wow.
Thank you so much for helping us reach this milestone. But we have a favor to ask.
If you know anyone on the continent of Antarctica, please ask them to download one or more episodes of the Talk About Teddy podcast.
So remember, if you have any questions, please send us an email at talkaboutteddypodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you for your encouragement, support, and continued interest.
President Theodore Roosevelt has been credited with many firsts. Some of these firsts attributed to TR may be more myth than fact. So for our show today, we will only discuss the firsts and mosts we can verify with reliable and documentable sources. We'll present TR's accomplishments chronologically, and all of our sources will be available on the blog on our website, talkaboutteddy.com.
All right, Larry. So one of our firsts here, Vice President Theodore Roosevelt became the youngest man ever to become the president at the age of 42, following the death of President William McKinley.
Yeah, President McKinley had been shot on September 6th at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, while TR was in Vermont on Lake Champlain speaking with the governor. And he ends up racing back to Buffalo to see how President McKinley was doing, and ends up going at the urging of the doctors and President McKinley's cabinet to join his family in the Adirondacks on a camping trip. So TR heads up that way, and he gets a telegram and in the evening races off the mountain from the Tejas Club where he was staying down to the North Creek Station and eventually to Buffalo. And that day becomes the youngest president
in American history. So we've got some folks immediately think John F. Kennedy being the youngest president ever elected at the age of 43 in 1960, which is true. Roosevelt is not elected in his own right until 1904, but comes to the presidency through the grave, as it were, in 1901, still the youngest person in American history to become president. So,
and number two, October 16th, 1901, TR is the first president to invite an African American to dine at the White House. He moved into the White House in late 1901, and he invited famed educator Booker T. Washington to have dinner with the first family. Now, TR had met Mr. Washington back in 1898 while he was governor, but the dinner sparked an angry backlash from Southern politicians and the press.
According,
according to some newspaper reports, they said, quote, several Negroes, end quote, attended a White House reception in January of 1903. Southern newspapers railed. The Roanoke Times in Virginia wrote that Teddy makes another break, implying that he had broken with etiquette and protocol. But yeah, Mr. Washington became an advisor to TR on race politics and Southern politics in general.
Yeah, we can't even read for public consumption any of even the headlines from many of the Southern newspapers when this first broke. But needless to say, Roosevelt continued to meet with Booker T. Washington just a little more discreetly in Washington, D.C. Well, speaking of the White House, it was Roosevelt who actually renamed the Executive Mansion, as it had been known since Thomas Jefferson had lived there, as the White House. So October 17, 1901, his Secretary George Cortelyou sent a letter to Secretary of State John Hay sharing TR's request to change the headings, the dateline, and all official papers and documents requiring the president's signature from the executive mansion to the, quote, White House. And similar directives were sent to all the other cabinet secretaries, and TR changed the presidential stationery shortly after that as well.
Yes, and even his calling cards TR had made that said White House, Washington.
Yeah, we take that for granted now, too.
Good change. We do. Our next one is in February of 1902, TR is the first president to study the Japanese martial art of jujitsu. There was an American physician, William Sturgis Bigelow. He may have introduced this martial art to TR. He also, TR did, took a number of lessons from Professor John O'Brien. I like TR's description of jujitsu, that it's marvelous, but difficult to learn. And in 1904, he had Yamashita Yoshiaki, an early student of judo, give him lessons at the White House for 2 months. And there's some that attribute TR studying the Asian martial arts and the press covering it to helping those arts gain a foothold in the U.S.
Yeah. So Bigelow, he was quite the student of Japan, I think a huge collector of Japanese art. He donated all of his art collection to museums in America. It's like the largest Japanese art collection outside of Japan, I believe. But yeah, I did find a letter of Bigelow introducing this guy, John J. Bryan, who'd been a police officer in Nagasaki. who was, you know, once he was, he, you know, living in Nagasaki, he picks up the jujitsu. He says that all the police officers there in Japan are trained in jujitsu. So, you know, of course, Roosevelt is fond of learning any new physical activity he can do in the White House there beside boxing and wrestling. I think he took lessons with O'Brien for a while there, and hurt himself, I think, not doing jiu-jitsu, but I think he took a good tumble in Rock Creek Park in D.C. and had to discontinue his lessons for a while. But yeah, this Yamashita Yoshiaki, apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. But
I mispronounced Bigelow as Bigelow. I apologize for that.
Yeah, and you can't help but wonder, too, you know, we're going to talk about this with a dispute between Japan and Russia, that I think Roosevelt had tremendous respect for the Japanese code of honor and chivalry and this, you know, physical arts of things like jujitsu, that he admired that in the Japanese culture.
Quite a bit, yes.
All right, well, we'll go move on to another here. We found that TR was the first president to be a member of a labor union. TR was the first president to attend a convention of a railway labor organization at the invitation of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. TR was president at the opening ceremonies of the convention in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then was elected to an honorary membership in the organization. Yep. And this is 1902.
Yeah, and he loved trains, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. He rode in the engine on some, not just for photo ops. There were times he would be the one guiding and directing the train. So,
but it does make for a good photo op.
Oh, it does too, yes. Well, our next one is June 17th, 1902. It was during TR's administration the first Water Reclamation Act was passed by Congress. In 1902, irrigation projects were known as reclamation projects. It was the idea that irrigation could reclaim the arid lands for human use. So supporters of irrigation believed these reclamation programs would encourage Western settlement. It allowed families to live on farms, and TR supported that movement because he believed in families and homesteading. So from 1902 to 1907, there were about 30 projects that began in the Western states for reclamation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another first. On August 22nd, 1902, TR was documented as the first president to use an automobile while conducting. official duties as president. So even though William McKinley was the first president to actually ride in a new automobile, it was T.R. the first to appear in an automobile as an official presidential appearance when he toured Hartford, Connecticut on the 22nd of August, 1902. It was said that cheering supporters greeted President Roosevelt at all points along the parade route, which he traversed, in the words of the Indianapolis Journal, a, quote, handsome Victoria automobile in charge of two expert New York chauffeurs.
Yeah. I love the vehicle he's in. It's the Columbia Electric Victoria Phaeton. It's like the other Phaeton. Columbia models. It had an external box for the driver that was up above. So it almost looks like a hansom cab, the carriages, but no horses. And there were two 20-volt batteries, about 800 pounds, that were on the automobile. The tires were made of rubber, and the driver had a choice of four speeds, with the maximum being 13 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the factory that made the Columbia electric vehicle, it was in Hartford, Connecticut. So perfect advertising to have the president ride around in the automobile that's made in your town when he visits. So.
Yeah, and what comes to mind, too, is daughter Alice racing around the streets of D.C. in an automobile, probably the first daughter to race around at speeds perhaps approaching 20 miles an hour.
The
nation's capital.
All right. Our next one is a sad one. On September 3rd, 1902, T.R. was the first president to have a Secret Service agent die in the line of duty. Agent William, Big Bill was his nickname, Craig. He had joined the United States Secret Service in 1900. Originally, Secret Service agents, their main duty was to arrest counterfeiters. But after President McKinley was assassinated in September of 1901, Congress passed legislation that added protecting the president to the official duties of the Secret Service. And Agent Craig had been with William McKinley when he was shot, and he had been assigned to the TR's protection detail. And TR called Agent Craig, quote, my shadow, end quote. And the Roosevelt children loved Agent Craig.
So it was September 3rd, 1902, and when Agent Craig was sitting in the front of the carriage when it was struck by that speeding trolley car, and it was in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and TR was riding in the back with the Massachusetts governor, Winthrop Crane, and also TR's personal secretary, George Corlew. Agent Craig was thrown from the carriage and crushed by the trolley. And the carriage driver was seriously injured, and TR was also thrown about 30 feet from the carriage, but only received bad cuts and bruises, and had a pretty nasty injury to his left leg that would cause him troubles for the rest of his life, really. Secretary Corlew had a cut to the back of the head, and one of the horses was so injured it had to be put down. But it seems that the Governor Crane escaped with no injury somehow. Agent Craig was of Scottish birth, born in 1855, and he was a big man, 6'4", weighed about 260, and he'd been in the Royal Horse Guards in the British Army, and supposedly was even tasked for a while with guarding Queen Victoria.
Yeah. I know TR said of Agent Craig that, quote, he was a sturdy character and tremendously capable in performing his duties. My children thought a great deal of him. We all did.
Yeah. Yeah, he was pretty crushed by the loss of Craig. Well, our next first, as it were, October 3rd, 1902, TR was the first president to act as a federal arbitrator between labor and management. So in this effort to settle this ongoing coal strike going into the winter of October 1902, TR called a meeting at the temporary White House in Lafayette Place in D.C., since the White House was being renovated. That's another story. So there was ongoing coal strike, the anthracite coal fields in Pennsylvania, and TR understood that there would be, quote, untold misery with the uncertainty of riots, which might develop into a social war. So he felt like he really had no choice but to intervene. So, you know, he sends telegrams to both sides, summoning them to Washington to talk about the problem. But again, he was still recovering from the injuries from that trolley accident we just talked about. And so there he is in his wheelchair, pleading with representatives of management and labor.
Yeah, there's a quote that he has that, "With all the earnestness there is in me, I ask that there be an immediate resumption of operations in the coal mines in some such way as will meet the crying needs of the people." So it took a lot of negotiating, but in the end, his efforts were successful. The strike ended, and both sides finally agreed to the findings of the Anthracite Coal Strike Commission, which TR had appointed that to investigate all the matters related to the strike. And peace was restored in the coal fields. And more important in the long run, a new role was established for the federal government in labor disputes. Now, the miners had asked for about 20% wage increase. Most were given about a 10% increase. They had also asked for an 8-hour work day. They had 10-plus hour work days. They were given a 9-hour work day.
Yeah, that's a big turning point for federal arbitration, labor disputes. Pretty much for much of American history, the government had always sided with business leaders against the interests of organized labor, for sure. So, big turning point.
Well, our next first is 1903. TR is the first president to install a tennis court at the White House. According to newspaper reports, the tennis court was completed in the spring of 1903, and it cost $2,500. It was installed under the direction of TR, although there's many historians who think Edith wanted the installation because she was worried about TR's growing waistline. He eventually created a tennis cabinet. It was a group of close advisors who played tennis with him in the afternoons. And there's photographs of the courts, there's photographs of the tennis cabinet, but you will never see a photograph of TR in the tennis outfit. So he thought that was a little too effete.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, how interesting that not a single picture has ever surfaced of TR wearing tennis attire.
He would not let it be done.
Yeah, very interesting. But so that tennis court, you will not see that very tennis court today. There is a tennis court on the White House grounds still, but it's in a different location. But this tennis court was put right behind what becomes the West Wing, which was part of that remodel that we had just talked about. So we'll put pictures of that up on the website as well.
Yeah,
along with TR and his tennis cabinet.
And I love the photograph of the tennis cabinet. They took the picture on March 1st, 1909, right before Taft's inauguration as TR was leaving. They had a luncheon. There was the TR's military aide, Captain Archie Butt, who later perishes on the Titanic. There's the chief U.S. Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot, French ambassador Jean-Jules Jusserand, the Secretary of the Interior, James R. Garfield, U.S. Marshal Seth Bullock, Secretary of State Robert Bacon, and even one of TR's ranch hands from the Elkhorn Ranch in the Dakotas, Bill Sewell, and a lot of other government friends and officials and all. So when they took the picture, they had the bronze by Alexander Proctor sculpture of Stalking Panther, and that's what they presented to TR as a commemoration of being on the tennis cabinet.
Which you can still see today in Sagamore Hill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where you will be headed in July.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'll give a promo for Kurt here.
And we just had a good conversation with Michael Patrick Cullinane that his ongoing research has to do with Roosevelt's tennis cabinet. So we are all very much looking forward to that upcoming book whenever that is released.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Our next first, T.R. was the first president to establish a national wildlife refuge. So on 14 March 1903, he establishes Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge on the Florida Atlantic coastline. So this is going to be the first of 51 bird preserves in the United States. Along those same lines, TR also establishes the first national game preserves, the Bison Preserve down in Wichita Forest, Oklahoma. So a lot of firsts associated with game preserve.
Yeah. Our next one, it's April 1st through June 5th, 1903. TR is the first president to use an entire train dedicated to campaign staff. It was during the 1903 Great Western Loop Tour. He starts April 1st in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, delivers 673 speeches, and travels over 21,000 miles. And like we mentioned earlier with the trains, he loved to ride in the cab, and he knew how to operate the locomotive pulling the heavy loads. John Quincy Adams was the first president to ever ride in a train, but TR had the entire train dedicated to his staff. So all the way from Harrisburg, across the U.S. to Yellowstone, back down around to St. Louis, then over to the Grand Canyon, and then to Yosemite with Mr. John Muir, camping in those three eventful evenings, and then heading back.
Think of that, over 2 months traveling all of the western United States by train.
Yeah.
A lot of people call that a vacation, but when you look at, 673 speeches in a two-month period across two dozen states, I mean, that's astonishing.
Well, I know I was reading the book about the Marquette libel trial that TR was involved in, and they had the depositions there and the statements on the witness stand. And TR mentioned that when his voice would grow hoarse from too much speaking, which happened quite a bit to him, 1900, all these different times. His cure, I've never attempted this, was a glass of milk with a teaspoonful of brandy right before bed. I'm not sure that's a cure I'd be tempted to try, but...
Yeah, that was probably about the extent of his drinking, too, from
pretty much,
most accounts.
I mean, there's some white wine at supper, but... We may have to do that as another podcast, the Marquette Libel Trial.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Put it on the list, Larry. Well, we've got another first. TR was the first president to send a trans-Pacific cable for the purpose of diplomacy. On the 4th of July, 1903, TR completed the cable from San Francisco to Manila via the Commercial Pacific Cable Company. Mm-hmm. TR commemorated that opening by sending a telegraph message that connected those links from Manila all the way from Oyster Bay, Long Island. The message reportedly took about 12 minutes to arrive.
And he was sending that
instantaneous.
Down to Governor William Howard Taft, who was in Manila.
Right, right. That would have been Governor General Taft in Manila. That's right.
Our next first, August 22nd, 1905. TR is the first president to be submerged in a submarine. He climbs aboard the USS Plunger. I'm not certain about that name. In Long Island Sound.
Yeah.
He goes on board about 3:30 in the afternoon, and he stays on board until a little after 6. And at one point, they spent around an hour completely submerged. And I remember reading one account where TR wanted to turn all the dials and pull the levers, and the captain of the vessel would not allow it, understandably. Yeah. There's a great illustration with the news article about it that shows TR in every crevice and corner of this submarine trying to, you know, work all the instruments and everything there. It's a great picture. We'll post that one on the site.
Yeah, I mean, in 1905, this is early technology. This is pretty rudimentary, this submarine. Yeah, and I was reading one of the early commanders of this was right out of the Naval Academy, Ensign Chester Nimitz, who becomes a future fleet admiral.
Yeah.
So shortly after this, this thing is commanded by the future five-star admiral Nimitz. So it's pretty amazing story. Okay, so I guess continuing on with the conservation, June 8th, 1906, TR is the first president to proclaim a national monument. Because of the Antiquities Act, or the Act for the Preservation of American Antiquities, signed into law on the 8th of June, 1906, it's the first U.S. law that provides legal protection of cultural and natural resources of historic or scientific interest on federal lands. So TR then uses this act to, so Devil's Tower becomes that first national monument and the first of 18 national monuments.
Yeah, when you look through the list, there's a number of them that have become national parks. But we can go through the list for everyone if they'd like. We've got El Morro in New Mexico, 1906.
Montezuma Castle, Arizona, 1906.
Petrified Forest in Arizona, 1906, which is now a national park.
Yep, Chaco Canyon in New Mexico in 07.
Lassen Peak in California in 1907, which is now Lassen Volcanic National Park.
Along the Cinder Cone, also part of Lassen.
And then Gila Cliff Dwellings in New Mexico in 1907.
And Tonto in Arizona in 07.
And Muir Woods in California in 1908.
And then... And then this little piece of land down in Arizona called the Grand Canyon in 1908, which is now obviously a national park.
Yes. Same with Pinnacles in California. It was 1908, and it's now a national park.
And Jewel Cave in South Dakota in 08.
And Natural Bridges in Utah in 08.
Lewis and Clark Caverns in Montana, which is now a Montana state park.
And Tumacacori in Arizona in 1908.
And Wheeler here in my state of Colorado in 1908, which it's now now a geologic area, no longer a designation as a national monument.
Yeah. It's part of the Rio Grande National Forest. And then we have Mount Olympus in Washington from 1909. It's now part of Olympic National Park.
Wow.
Yeah. And continuing with the conservation, from 1902 to 1906, TR was the first president to establish five national parks during his administration. Previous presidents, from President Grant on, had saved six national parks. The first was Yellowstone in 1872, established by President Grant. And then the next one, from 1875 to 1895, was Mackinac National Park, which became Mackinac Island State Park in 1895. So it's not counted as one of the national parks when TR becomes president, since it had been taken out. And then the third, fourth, and fifth national parks were in 1890. Sequoia National Park, General Grant National Park, which is now known as General Grant's Grove in Kings Canyon National Park. And then Yosemite National Park under President Benjamin Harrison. And then in 1895, President William McKinley established Mount Rainier National Park.
So the five that TR creates then, his first is Crater Lake National Park in Oregon in 02, Wind Cave in South Dakota in 03, Sully's Hill in North Dakota, which that was in 1904, and that's now called White Horse Hill. It's a national game preserve managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You got Platte National Park in Oklahoma in 06, which is now also part of the Chickasaw National Recreation Area. And then once again here in my home state, Mesa Verde National Park down in the southwest corner of Colorado in 1906.
Yeah.
Another first here, TR was the first president to leave the country during his time in office. This is November 9th, 1906. So TR and Mrs. Roosevelt board the USS Louisiana to visit and inspect the ongoing construction of the Panama Canal, which Roosevelt also has a major role in getting through.
Yep.
So some in Congress were afraid that this would create some sort of a constitutional crisis, but TR had made the arrangements with his Secretary of State, Elihu Root, to keep in touch with TR by means of wireless telegraphy during the voyage. So when TR and his party arrived in Panama, the regular telegraph cable was used to keep in close touch with the office. And TR is accompanied by his wife Edith and Surgeon General Rixey, the Assistant Secretary Maurice Lotta from the White House, and three Secret Service agents. And he gets back to the United States on November 26th, 1906. So he's out of the country for a couple of weeks. But again, first time it had ever happened, and created a bit of consternation.
I think it may have been his way of getting even with Congress for a couple of things. So.
Yeah.
Our next first is December 12th, 1906. TR is the first president to appoint a Jewish cabinet member, Oscar Straus of New York City. He was appointed by TR to head the Commerce and Labor Department. And this was a cabinet post that TR had created on February 14th, 1903, the Department of Commerce and Labor. So, yeah, a couple firsts almost.
Yeah. 1906, TR becomes the first president and the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize, received for his negotiation of the Russo-Japanese War. So it was that Treaty of Portsmouth that formally ended the Russo-Japanese War, which had raged for a couple of years, 1904-1905. And so the negotiations took place in August in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, brokered in part by President Roosevelt. The final agreement signed in September of 1905, and it essentially gave the Japanese the presence in South Manchuria and Korea and ceded the southern half of the island of Sakhalin to Japan.
Yeah. And TR
so
didn't...
When did he actually get the medal, you think, Larry?
Well, I know he delivered his Nobel lecture in Oslo, Norway, on May 5th, 1910. He was coming back from his African safari and was touring through Europe, headed over to the funeral of King Edward VII. And one of my favorite parts of that speech, I'd like to read that as TR in his voice if I could here. "Peace is generally a good in itself, but it is never the highest good unless it comes as the handmaid of righteousness. And it becomes a very evil thing if it serves merely as a mask for cowardice and sloth, or as an instrument to further the ends of despotism or anarchy." I couldn't resist. Sorry.
Every TR quote, you've got to get the word righteousness in there.
Yes.
And despotism and sloth. Yeah, that's good.
Mark Hanna, Senator Hanna, and others were afraid that TR would get us into wars and everything. But he was actually a president of peace. Well, our next first for TR is actually a world record. It was January 1st, 1907. He sets a world record for a head of state shaking hands with 8,513 people at the official function on New Year's Day at the White House reception. Now, he wasn't the first president to open the White House to visitors on January 1st. But he was the first to shake that many hands on a day. And you did the averaging. How much was it? How many hands per minute?
Yeah, so this is over the course of about 3 hours. So, you know, we're talking an average of about 45 hands a minute. we'll try to post on the website a video of Roosevelt in a reception line. Whether it's this actual day or not, I can't recall. But you see his style of shaking and kind of pulling people along as they go and keeping them moving.
Yeah, I've read an account where when he was shaking hands, if the line wasn't moving fast enough, he would ask the Marine Corps band to play the songs a little faster. So that would help give him the momentum to keep the hands moving.
I know. So Edmund Morris in The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt writes that that day, the president invited, quote, "all citizens who are sober, washed, and free of bodily advertising," end quote, to come and meet him. It says, though it was January, the weather was perfect, and the citizens, men, women, and children of all ages lined up at the White House and waited their turn patiently. So, pretty great.
Yeah, that's one piece I'd like to travel back in time to, just to go through and shake hands with him.
Shake his hand. Yep. He had a good, firm handshake by all accounts.
Yeah.
So. All right. So December 16th, 1907 to February 22nd, 1909, T.R. was the first president to send a portion of the U.S. Navy to circumnavigate the globe in what was called the Great White Fleet.
Yeah, the Great White Fleet, it announced to the world that the growing American military power had a global reach, especially with the new and modern Navy that T.R. had helped push for when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President McKinley. Mm-hmm. So in this way, T.R. used the fleet to represent what he saw as America's arrival as a great nation on the world stage. He was devoted to naval theorist Alfred Thayer Mahan, and he equated international power with naval might. So T.R. supported the new battleship construction, the modernization of armaments, and even the adoption of new marksmanship techniques. And in doing so, he greatly expanded the reach of American power. It was something that President William McKinley had started, and T.R. pushed on through.
Yeah, this is what Roosevelt had always stood for, even what he advocated clear back in his early book, The Naval War of 1812, that American preparedness is what will keep us safe, that peace through preparedness. And so this was a, really stark demonstration to the world that America had an offensive capability with these battleships sent around the world. We had the capability in peace to project naval power. Yeah. So we'll let you just put two and two together there. If it comes to war, then certainly we're capable of employing that naval power if we need to.
Our next first was May 13th to 15th, 1908, and it's going along with conservation again. T.R. is the first president to convene a national governor's conference. He called the meeting to highlight the urgency of conservation of natural resources. He felt there was no greater moral issue facing the American people at that time than the conservation of our natural wonders and our natural resources. So he hand-wrote an invitation to each governor, and at least 40 governors attended. The speakers included experts on waterways, mining, forestry, and T.R. himself. Each governor had the opportunity to talk briefly about the needs of their own states and any solutions that were successful in those states. And one thing I love, they blocked out the windows in the East Room of the White House and projected large maps onto the walls. I think that's pretty impressive technology for 1908.
Yeah.
Just thinking how far-reaching and advanced that was for that time to look to the future, to know that we needed to conserve. And it was another first there, too, because it was the first time scientists and political leaders were viewed on equal footing with an issue as strong as this. There's a whole book dedicated to the Governor's Conference from 1908, and I highly recommend finding that one. It's all the accounts, the minutes, the speeches. It's a wonderful read.
Yeah. Well, another first here that's near and dear to our hearts.
Yeah.
October 11th, 1910, T.R. becomes the first, in this case, ex-president, but the first person who had ever been president to ride in an airplane. He didn't pilot the thing, but he rode in an airplane. October 11th, 1910, Roosevelt stays aloft for about 4 minutes in a Wright Brothers-built plane in Kennelick Field in St. Louis, piloted by Arch Hoxie. So later, his fifth cousin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, becomes the first president in office to fly in a plane in the 1930s. But so, Larry, I happen to know, I think this was my first time I had ever heard your name was seeing you in a video in a 2010 recreation of this flight. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, we were at the Dayton Air Show with some friends, and a Wright B flyer, which was the model that TR had flown in, flew overhead. And I knew about TR's story of flying in the Wright B flyer, and I contacted the place that owned that, the Wright Brothers Airport in Dayton, Ohio, and for a fee, you can join the organization and get a free flight. So I did. And we recreated the flight on October 11th, 2010, 100 years to the day. And the local news stations were there, and one gentleman edited together a video, and that's what's posted on my website. When you watch the motion picture of TR, which they took one, of him getting out of the automobile, getting onto the airplane, going up with Arch Hoxie, going about 300 feet high and nosediving three times. We didn't do that on ours.
You didn't recreate the nosedives.
No, stuff. We had crosswinds that were about 25 to 30 or so miles an hour. And my pilot was amazing. Don Gum was his name. He took us up, and that wind carried us off the runway over the trees nearby, and he was able to bring the plane back. We landed, went around again, and took off again. You see the grin on TR's face when he gets off of the plane. I experienced that. It's like a motorcycle with wings. That's about the best way to describe a Wright B flyer. It just,
yeah.
But there is a sad aspect of this story for TR and for myself. A couple months after TR's flight, pilot Arch Hoxie with the Wright Air Meet was in California and attempted to do an altitude record and lost consciousness and crashed and was killed. Oh, a few months after my flight, pilot Don Gum with another pilot was flying an experimental Wright B flyer that they had worked on, and it crashed not far from where I live in Ohio, and he was killed. So, yeah.
Goodness sakes. No, I didn't know that part.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it just, that was rough, and I can imagine TR felt something like I felt with losing the pilot and, you know, the exhilaration of being on the plane, sharing that with someone.
Right.
And, so it was.
Yeah, that's too bad. I never knew that the rest of that, of your particular story. I had known about Hoxie because he had just, a few days earlier in that, had set a flight altitude record in a similar plane. And here he was, just a few days later trying to best his own record. Yeah. That's too bad.
Ugh. But if you do get a chance, Library of Congress has the video. I recommend watching that and just looking at that smile on TR's face as he steps off. And I'm sure Alice was jealous.
I think I will post a video of both TR's 1910 and Larry's 2010 videos side by side. Very good.
Oh, thanks, Kurt. Yep. Well, our next first is 1912. TR is the first former president of the United States to be elected to the presidency of the American Historical Association.
Yay.
He's noted for a number of historical works, the Naval War of 1812, which there's many people that still consider that the best work on the subject, and his four-volume series, Winning of the West.
It's a big deal, I think, for Roosevelt to be recognized as a co-equal with these professional historians with their PhDs. You know, Roosevelt did not have a PhD in history, as so many did.
He had honorary degrees, but yeah.
Honorary, right, honorary doctorate. I would say his historical work probably outsold the majority of the very academic works of most historians in the AHA at that time.
Yeah.
Roosevelt wrote what we would call today popular histories, probably more on par with the Stephen Ambroses and the Doris Kearns Goodwins and Douglas Brinkley's, who all have PhDs.
All of them. Yeah.
But Roosevelt wrote, in his history as literature, that history needs to be written to be interesting to the average person, needs to put flesh onto bones, as he said.
Yeah. In my classroom, I have a poster that says, "History is boring," and at the bottom in huge letters, "Not." And it's showing a ship of the line from the War of 1812 or Revolution, somewhere in that time frame, firing a broadside. And so my kids will always look at that and go, "History is boring. Not."
Well, something we'll wrap up this episode here with a final first. Again, this list has not been all-inclusive. There are others, and we may have a part two episode down the line. But this is a good start, at least. But we'll finish this episode with T.R. as the first president to be awarded the Medal of Honor, in this case posthumously. But January 16th, 2001, despite Roosevelt's efforts and the lobbying by his superior officers, he was initially denied the Medal of Honor by the War Department during his time, and it took more than a century for the nation to change its mind. So again, on January 16th, 2001, the former president finally received this honor, and so it was in the White House, in the Roosevelt Room. Matter of fact, this was one of the last official acts of President William Clinton, and this Medal of Honor was presented to T.R.'s great-grandson, Tweed Roosevelt, and that medal is still on display there in the Roosevelt Room in the White House next to the big Roosevelt portrait, and I think on the other side of the portrait is T.R.'s Nobel Prize medal as well. So that truly is the Roosevelt Room. So this Roosevelt Room is where Roosevelt had his office there originally before we had the creation of the Oval Office. Can I read the citation? This is from what Roosevelt described as his crowded hour in Cuba. "For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty, Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Roosevelt distinguished himself by acts of bravery on the 1st of July, 1898, near Santiago de Cuba, Republic of Cuba, while leading a daring charge up San Juan Hill. Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt, in total disregard for his personal safety and accompanied by only four or five men, led a desperate and gallant charge up San Juan Hill, encouraging his troops to continue the assault through withering enemy fire over open countryside. Facing the enemy's heavy fire, he displayed extraordinary bravery throughout the charge and was the first to reach the enemy trenches, where he quickly killed one of the enemy with his pistol, allowing his men to continue the assault. His leadership and valor turned the tide in the battle for San Juan Hill. Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, and the United States Army."
Yes. Now, T.R.'s son, Ted Jr., he also receives the Medal of Honor. They are one of only two father-son pairs to do that. The other was Arthur MacArthur Jr. and his son Douglas MacArthur. But Ted Jr. was in World War I, a decorated officer and wounded. And then in World War II, he gained a reputation in both wars of leading from the front. And at 56 years of age, Ted Jr. was the oldest man to storm the beaches of Normandy and the only general officer to storm on the first wave of the assault on D-Day. And he earned his medal at Utah Beach for, quote, "gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty," end quote, while leading successive waves of troops inland to their objectives. And, he had made two requests to lead the invasion and had been denied. And eventually he's allowed to. And when they land, he's told they're a mile south of their objective, and should we get back in the boats and go that mile? And he said, "No, we'll start the war from right here." And under constant heavy fire throughout the day, he directed the men and material the best routes to gain a foothold in France and push on in to destroy Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
But, he's awarded his September 21st, 1944, and Ted had died a month after D-Day of a heart attack, and he's buried at the Normandy Cemetery, and right next to him is his brother Quentin, who was shot down and killed in World War I. Quentin's the only World War I soldier buried in the Normandy cemetery.
Yeah, the decision was made by the family. They would move his grave from northern France into the cemetery there. So you go there today, you see those two brothers' headstones side by side. It's pretty moving to see that. And the other piece of that, speaking of Quentin, when Quentin had died in the First World War, all the rest of the Roosevelt boys said whoever had the next son born would name their son Quentin in their brother's honor. And so it was Quentin II that landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day. And so that, you know, one more distinction even for the Roosevelt family, that you had the only father and son with that first wave on the D-Day landings. So it's pretty astonishing story there for the Roosevelts' military service record. And I think we definitely could get another episode talking just about the military service of the extended Roosevelt family in all of our wars.
Just T.R.'s children alone, from Ethel being the first one to go over. I mean, there's so many stories there. Yep, and I think we'll have to write that one down as another podcast. Yeah, it's a shame we just don't have enough topics, you know. It's
yeah, exactly.
Well, Kurt, I think this has been a good discussion of just maybe our first podcast on the first of TR. So there's many more, and as we research and document those, hopefully we'll be able to get another episode out there with more firsts.
Yeah, most assuredly. Yeah. So Larry and I will be doing more episodes, just the two of us, talking about particular topics as we go on. But again, we do have a goodly number of guests on our program coming up for the next couple of months, and so stay tuned for those. And so thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Also, don't forget, if you have any questions you want Kurt and I to answer, please send those to talkaboutteddypodcast@gmail.com. There's a link to be able to access the Gmail through our website, talkaboutteddy.com.
We look forward to your questions.
Yep. Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening.
You can find this podcast on our website, talkaboutteddy.com, where you can see show notes and transcripts, links to resources, and additional TR content. And please tell us what you think.
If you've enjoyed our content, please consider subscribing and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, and tell your friends and family about us, because it really does make a tremendous difference and it helps others find this show.
We hope you'll join us for the next episode of Talk About Teddy. And until then, as our friend Colonel Roosevelt would say,
do what you can with what you have where you are.
Bullet.